Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday on Progressive Radio at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. I'm a health, food, and environmental journalist who's been covering these matters for over two decades. And every week on this show, we connect your personal health to your total health environment. All of the prescriptions and advice we hear about bettering personal health can only happen and can best happen in a social context where we have access to healthy food, water, air, and earth, as well as healthy communities and a healthy society. So every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss different facets of this with experts, thought leaders, advocates, authors, and a whole host of different people. And today's show is really great. I want to apologize because I have a little bit of a cold today, summer cold, so you may hear that as I speak. As we do most weeks, I'm just going to begin with a quick action opportunity that you can take, and then we'll move into our show guest that I know a lot of people are eager to listen to. I posted the show announcement last night on Facebook and got such a terrific response. But I also want to alert anyone in the New York area that June 17th is a very special day when citizens from across the state will drive to Albany in order to ask Governor Cuomo to reject fracking and lead the nation in constructing a renewable energy economy here in New York State. I've covered fracking a lot on this show. If you have any questions about it, please go to the Connect the Dots archives and learn more about it. You can also check out my blog, healthjournalistblog.com, for plenty of articles, as well as look me up on Alternet. To get more information about the rally, sign up. There are buses going from all different areas. Please go to nyagainstfracking.org, and you'll find a whole bunch of ways to find rides, to get on buses, and to attend this very important, critical march and rally. And now let's move on to the main part of our show, where we're going to be discussing today another major action, series of actions to protect our food supply and from GMOs. And this is a topic we've covered on Connect the Dots extensively. And we have some good news to report on today's show, breaking news, in fact. With me today are people that have been my guests before in the show, and they regularly appear from time to time on Connect the Dots and update us on their terrific and very successful organizing efforts on behalf of protecting our food supply. And they are Dave Murphy and Lisa Stocke. They're co-founders and directors of Food Democracy Now, which is one of the most successful, vocal, hardworking grassroots organizations to protect the food supply by labeling GMOs so that at least people have a choice and an opportunity to make a personal choice for themselves and their families as to whether they wish to eat them or not. And, you know, something like 90% of people wish to make that choice, but there are a host of industries that oppose it. So David and Lisa will be discussing this on today's show, and we'll also be joined by Tara Cook-Littman, who has recently been part of a key, a critical effort that successfully has passed the first GMO labeling law in the United States, in Connecticut. Tara Cook-Littman is the director of GMO Free Connecticut. And they've just had in the last couple of days an enormous and surprising win that you're going to hear all about on today's show. So welcome, Dave, Lisa, and Tara to Connect the Dots.
Hey, Allison, pleasure to be on.
It's great to have you guys.
Hi, Allison.
Hi.
How are you? We're so happy to be here with you today. Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you guys. So let's, before we get into this really thrilling good news and recent breaking story, let's just back up for, you know, it's only in the last couple of weeks that we had the March Against Monsanto with, you know, I don't know, maybe you can tell us what the exact figures were, the participants all around the world in hundreds of different cities in this country and abroad marching against Monsanto and the, you know, the spread of GMOs. Can you kind of update us a little on that? It wasn't well covered in the major media, although I think we did get some coverage eventually. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, I think it was over, in over 400 cities. There were probably half a million to a million people that showed up, various cities.
Okay, I think we're having
a variety of estimates.
I think we have you. Your sound is kind of bouncing in and out a bit, Dave. There, we're not hearing you all that clearly. Can either Lisa or Tara take the question? Because I think we have a little sound problem there, unfortunately. Okay. Well, that seems to be better. Go for it.
Sure. Well, I think there were events in over 400 cities, and it's hard to tell ultimately how many people showed up. I mean, it's several hundred thousand, over a half a million to a million, probably. It was a pretty remarkable event that took place on May 25th. And I think that, really what happens is people just finally said they'd had enough after the passage of the Monsanto Protection Act and the approval of so many different crops. People finally just got out in the streets and said, we're going to take this argument into to the people and let people know and let elected officials know that we're really tired of having at least this one corporation write the rules and regulations that govern our food and with no recourse from the federal government. That's really kind of the crux of it. People are tired of allowing companies like Monsanto to have absolute control over our food and a basic part of our economy and our daily lives with no recourse for our elected officials.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Monsanto Protection Act?
Sure. The Monsanto Protection Act, it's a name that I gave the Farmer Assurance Provision. It's Section 735 in H.R. 933, which is a must-pass continuing resolution spending bill. Unfortunately, because of the gridlock and the breakdown in leadership in Washington, D.C., Republicans and Democrats for the past several years have been unable to get together and pass an annual budget like they normally do. And so what they've had to do is pass these continuing resolutions. And so Monsanto took advantage of this crisis, and they snuck in a provision that benefited them and their crops. And so the reason this is put in there is because Center for Food Safety and the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth successfully sued Monsanto in 2010 regarding Roundup GMO sugar beets and alfalfa. And they delayed the planting and the approval of those crops. So Monsanto got a special, interest corporate loophole that protected them and their crops from, during the process of judicial review. If there was a court case taking place, Monsanto, and after their crops have been approved by the USDA, Monsanto or a farmer could say, I want to plant this crop, even though the lawsuit may take 1 or 2 years and ultimately decide that this crop is illegal or harmful to the environment, I want to plant it now. And I'm going to offer, and the USDA has no other option, the Secretary of Agriculture has no option, but to authorize my planting of that. That's essentially what it did.
Mm-hmm. So you've been putting forth a great effort on that. Has it been upturned? What's the status of that right now?
So, Food Direction, now we managed to deliver 250,000 comments to the White House and to the USDA and members of Congress. In March, after this passed, we now have over 310,000 on our original petition, and probably close to over 100,000 on the effort for Jeff Senator Merkley from Oregon, who's a Democrat from Oregon. He has put forward an amendment to the Farm Bill to repeal the Monsanto Protection Act, and unfortunately, at this point, it looks like Senator Blunt has blocked him from being able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been going in the ongoing debate in the Farm Bill, which is happening 2 weeks ago and then again this week.
So that's also something that people can go to Food Democracy Now! And take action on that as well, the show listeners can go, because that's still in progress and a very important win-lose provision on a national level. Listeners can go to your website, Food Democracy Now!, and you can act on that, because now is the critical time window for that. Yeah, that's really terrific. From the march, I had on my Facebook page about, 20 or 30 different, photographs that friends from all around the world sent and circulated, of themselves in everywhere from South Africa to Amsterdam, Boston, Seattle, everywhere, Washington, D.C. You know, is there any feedback from that event? I know that a lot more of the general public kind of became aware of it, but because of the very sort of limited media coverage, has there been, you know, what has been the aftermath of that from your perspective?
Well, I think people, you know, it was a very successful event, and I think people were excited to get out and to hear and learn that there are more people in their community that support, you know, that support labeling of genetic engineered foods and want to hold Monsanto accountable. Mm-hmm. I know that they're planning an event a year from now on the same anniversary, on the same date, and they may try to do something on World Food Day, October 16th.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that the fact is, it's important for people to be out in the streets and marching and to show their outrage, but it's really more important for people to be involved in the legislative process and to help get bills passed. I mean, this is where we need the help, is on the farm bill to stop Monsanto from taking over. And, you know, the thing is, Monsanto, you know, they have lobbyists in state capitals, in D.C.'s capital every day. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate enough here in Connecticut to be able to ride that with a very well-organized grassroots effort. And very smart, you know, people on the ground like Tara. I mean, Tara did an amazing job working with her elected officials in a 2-year process to get a bill passed, which, you know, and there was real stiff opposition from the biotech industry. And that's not something that, you know, is won in the streets. That has to be an inside legislative battle that we need people that we're out in the streets, you know, for that day of protest. We need them to be active. When we send out calls to action, either make phone calls to the governor's office or to Congress, they need to respond with the same kind of enthusiasm. It's more important to get these bills passed to protect farmers and mm-hmm. protect our seed supply than anything else. Mm-hmm. We're really at a tipping point here in fighting Monsanto and this and corporate power here in the U.S. And I think we can take them on. We just have to harness and mobilize people's energy a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
We're very close.
Mm-hmm. There's certainly been a huge spread of awareness, a huge volume of people. The 90% of people that would prefer that or have become more active about it, I think because concerns have been raised about whether the healthy food that we all rely on will really be available if these seeds and plants disseminate and kind of take over the food supply. And there's also been growing concern about their health impacts. So we can discuss some of those points a little later on. But for now, I'd love to hear from you, Tara Cook-Littman, as the director of GMO-Free Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what it took to get this great win. I mean, you know, tell us what your process was and tell us what's recently happened.
Hi there. This is Tara. Thank you for having us on this morning.
Happy to have you. Great. Congratulations, you know.
Thank you. Thank you. We're all really thrilled. And really what it took is the people rising up and using their voices. And while GMO labeling was such a critical thing that we are working toward, we really do hope that the legacy of this will be that the people really can make a difference. And too often we've given away our power as citizens of this country. We throw our hands up in the air and think that corporate control of our government is inevitable. And we just proved in Connecticut that if the people band together, unite, and use their voices, we really can make our legislators, our lawmakers work for us instead of big business.
That's a huge, huge shift. I mean, we took it for granted for many years that that's what was happening. I think people have been waking up. Many people have woken up, and many more are waking up each day to the fact that we're in a context where that isn't, you know, something we can take for granted. It needs to be, you know, re-won in a certain kind of sense. So tell our listeners how you did that in Connecticut. I mean, when you began, for example, you know, were the legislators all, you know, on board with this? Or, you know, what kind of situation did it look like when you went out to try to persuade them that this was something to be done?
No, they definitely weren't on board. We had a real uphill struggle, and most people told us that even this year it was never going to happen because for the majority of the session, really until last week, the governor and the Speaker of the House were against the bill. So we knew that with the leadership not being supportive, we really did have a long uphill battle. Last year, we knew it was a really long shot because it was the first year, and it really all came together when the bill was first called for a hearing last year, and a big group of us met up and we said, okay, we're going to really band together and try to get this passed. And we were very disappointed by the result last year, but we came back more resolved this year. And last year, we were probably considered more on the fringe. I like to tell people they thought we were a bunch of crazy moms and environmentalists. But this year, we really were able to, through spending time with our legislators and getting them to trust us, we were able to convince them that we were a legitimate movement with power and that it was going to be bad for them politically if they did not support us, as evidenced by the vote. Altogether, including the Senate and the House, only three legislators voted against the bill in the entire
How did you persuade them it was going to be bad for them when they were kind of ignorant about that?
Well, power in numbers. We really turned out the numbers when we had rallies, and we turned out the numbers in terms of emails and phone calls and a presence at the Capitol. And so they felt that when legislators are receiving phone call after phone call and email after email from their constituents, they have no choice but to listen. That's the beauty of this. We just forget to use our voices. But once you actually do use your voices, it works. And last week, with the help of Food Democracy Now!, we were able to generate over 40,000 phone calls to the governor and speaker of the House, which is tremendous.
That's incredible. That's just incredible. They didn't know what hit them.
They didn't know what hit them. They really were probably begging for it to stop. They really did want it to stop. And that was when, after we had those days of phone calls, that was when the leadership of the Senate, the leadership of the House, and the governor's office all came together and said, okay, let's come up with a bill that we can all live with. And we're really thrilled with the language of the bill. It's a very strong bill in that the definition of genetically engineered is very strong. It's very consistent globally. The requirement that GMOs be labeled is very powerful. There is a trigger clause that I just do want to point out that will require other states to pass a law before ours actually goes into effect. So there are some people that are disappointed by that, but we actually look at it as a rallying cry for other states to really get motivated, and we urge lawmakers everywhere to follow Connecticut's lead. And we really do have faith in the activists in other states, the other GMO labeling warriors, that that they can do it. If we did, they can.
Well, let me bounce that question back to Dave Murphy and Lisa Stocky. either of you can take this question, which is, who are the other likely states that might step up and do this in order to kind of, I'm sure it may be too soon to kind of be asking you what your follow-up plans are, but, you know, are any other states well-organized and close? Where do you stand on that?
Hi there. Yeah. You know, we really, we just like Tara said, I mean, we really feel confident that there are, you know, other states that are pulling together. We have some amazingly solid leaders in Maine and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and, you know, New York is emerging. I realize that New York just, you know, unfortunately, their bill didn't make it out of committee. But, you know, New York really is, you know, concerned about this issue as well, of course. So, you know, we do expect, you know, a couple of other states to be passing here for sure, you know, really, really soon. We're seeing, like, the grassroots energy there. And as I reminded people at the rally here in Connecticut a couple of days ago, that Connecticut is just a really remarkable example of what is possible, you know, when the people really let it be known, you know, what they want, you know, how they want their government to run, what they want their legislators to do, that, you know, it really is democracy the way that democracy was intended, what our founding fathers wanted it to be, where these people are representative of what their people want. They represent that. And that happened here in Connecticut.
That's so incredibly exciting. And let me ask a question, which is, you know, were there lessons learned, or what were the differences? Because, you know, the vote last election season, Prop 37 in California, was such a close vote. You had an array of big industries funneling a lot of money into the opposition. Can you talk a little bit about the industries, and also, did they do the same thing in Connecticut, or did they kind of underestimate the situation, or were they really pushing back hard in the same way that they were in California?
Well, listen, you know, you mentioned a really good point. These companies that poured in millions of dollars, I mean, Monsanto, I kind of feel sorry for them. They spent $8.1 million in California, right? That's you know, really a lot. That's a down payment on deceiving the American public. And, you know, the good news is organizers here in Connecticut were able to kick their butt and with little or no money at all. And they, of course, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars here, the biotech industry did in Connecticut. You know, the interesting thing is Val Giddings, who is a biotech lobbyist, promoter, he's essentially, you know, a GMO hack. He came to the state capitol here in Connecticut, and they did, the legislators, I've never seen anything like this in my life. I'm from Iowa, at least, and I lived in Iowa. I've been a lobbyist in the Iowa State Capitol before for a session, so I know what it's like to have elected officials at a public hearing interact with, you know, industrial ag lobbyists. And literally, they spanked Val Giddings this whole hearing in March, essentially over the fact that he claimed that biotech seeds are improved seeds, that through the process of genetic engineering, you have an improved seed. Which everyone knows is kind of, you know, if you talk to Dr. Huber's research in the past, the fact of genetic engineering, inserting artificial genes into a seed and into a plant, it actually weakens that plant, but it does make it be able to tolerate a poison weed killer like Roundup. So the interesting thing is, you know, they tried to push back here in Connecticut, but they weren't able to. And the fact is, you know, we know in Washington State there's a ballot initiative this fall in November, you know, which could be the fourth state to pass a GMO labeling bill by that point. I think Lisa mentioned that Maine is on the verge of passing it, and other states, there's currently in their legislature. We understand this is a crisis mode for Monsanto, and that's great. You know, finally a group of moms and grassroots activists have kicked the crap out of the biotech lobby in a very small state, and they did that through pretty common, basic grassroots organizing techniques. And they're able to overcome the millions of dollars that Monsanto typically pours in. I mean, last year, the federal government in Washington, D.C., Monsanto spent $6 million to buy off our elected officials to get policies to support them. They managed to get the Monsanto Protection Act. And, you know, I'm just saying, we've exposed their corruption on a wider scale than ever imaginable before. When they passed the Monsanto Protection Act, Jon Stewart, CNN, you know, Fox News, everyone were so outraged that they reported it. The fact is they've been doing these shenanigans for 50 years, and what products they've been producing. And the mainstream media has refused to report on it. Finally, we're now starting to see light of day. And, you know, fortunate we have a coalition of states of people that are working across 37 states to pass labeling bills. It's only a matter of time before we have a national labeling bill. And there's nothing Monsanto can do about it. They're already trying to negotiate the terms of surrender in Washington, D.C.
Wow, that's incredible. So basically, you know, it's kind of like the unfortunate learning of the past decade or more has kind of been, you know, money talks. But what you're proving through this whole process is that people still talk louder than money. And in fact, in addition to the concerns over food and all the rest of it, the extraordinary thing about this is that you know, it's a model for all other industries. I mean, you know, as everyone knows, I've reported a great deal on this issue, but also on fracking. We don't know whether we'll have a win on that one, but it certainly has risen to awareness. So many more people are aware of it, concerned about it. So it's actually, it functions, what you're doing functions as a model for, you know, a whole bunch of different industries, and it's something that people could feel sort of optimistic about instead of feeling like, oh, what can I do about it, which I think is, you know, sort of the fallback position, unfortunately, in certain cases. What's your thought about that?
I mean, you know, I agree with you 100%. You know, people have to be optimistic. I mean, I think what Tara managed to do in Connecticut, I think what grassroots leaders are doing across the states, and we almost did in California. Let's be very honest with ourselves. We overcame an onslaught of $46 million. You know, that is an avalanche of corporate dollars that was meant to defeat us and to beat us back. But the American people are tired of this. They're tired of having corporations run roughshod over their basic democratic rights. I mean, it is a model. People need to rise up. They need to understand that this is that these elected officials that go to Congress and go into these state capitals, they're not entities on their own. There are representatives. They should be working for us. And it is our civic duty and obligation, it is our moral duty to hold these people accountable. And we can, you know, we have to stop being distracted by Kim Kardashian and reality shows and all that stuff and Dancing with the Stars. And we have to look at what's really, really important in our lives. The fact that fracking is going to poison groundwater in rural areas and possibly poison groundwater in New York City is outrageous. Any elected official, I mean, any elected official that considers that an okay option, it's a disaster. We should hold them accountable. We need to have people running for office to have our beliefs. We need to have people in the GMO movement, in the fracking movement, run for office to turn mm-hmm. these losers out if they won't mm-hmm. do what we want. The mm-hmm. fact is, grassroots organizing. I always think that, you know, the internet is a lot like the Gutenberg press for online organizing. You can turn out hundreds of thousands of people, at events where never the fraction of a cost of what it would have done 10 or 20 years ago. That's a really mm-hmm. remarkable thing. We're connected on the internet now. Social media allows us to bring the beast down. You know, I think that's what's going to happen. And these companies are realizing it.
You know, it's interesting because something came across my site yesterday, which was a prominent physician who shall be nameless, who essentially wrote a piece saying, oh, you know, the poor legislators, senators, and congressmen, you know, they're making these poor decisions because, you know, they're not in good health. They're overworked. They're overtired. They're not eating a healthy diet. You know, gee, I wish I could just, I feel so sorry for them. I wish I could consult with them as a physician and improve their health, and I'm sure, you know, that then that would be a way for them, you know, to take a better approach to how we value health and make social priorities that value health in our society. And this, again, is a kind of, you know, top-down model. If only I can reach Senator so-and-so and turn him, you know, because he feels better, because he's, you know, he's on a better diet. You know, it's that one-by-one model. But it's kind of belied, isn't it, to a certain extent by by the fact that you don't need to, like, take Senator so-and-so and improve his health for a couple of years with, you know, when you have millions of people. I mean, you need to replace Senator so-and-so. What's yeah. your thought on that? It's a bit of a provocative question.
I think the best way to improve a senator's health that's not voting for the American people is to force him into retirement. And then he can focus on eating healthy food. You know, my goal, I wish that these elected officials would start to realize that organic food is the foundation to health here in the United States. It may take, you know, hitting them in the upside the head with a shovel or a few hundred thousand phone calls. But, you know, I'm not here to improve their health. I'm here to make sure that they create policies that improve the health of the American people. I think that's what mothers and parents are concerned across the United States. The food we produce, it's junk food. It's garbage. You go to the grocery store today, 70% of the processed food contains GMOs. We shouldn't mm-hmm. be even eating most of the processed food that's sold in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. We don't eat whole grains. We don't eat fresh fruits and vegetables. And that's the tragedy of it. And I think, you know, Tara can speak about why she got involved as a mother about this issue and to help successfully organize the first GMO labeling bill here in Connecticut. I mean, she had a great relationship with her elected officials. And Lisa and I have been here in Connecticut three times this year, and it's always been a pleasure to talk to I think elected officials here in Connecticut are a lot more educated about health issues than they are in the Midwest. So, you know, I think it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Well, let's do that. I think that would be a great topic to hear a little bit more personally about what those interactions were like with Tara. But we're coming into our break now, where we break for station identification. So let's do that after the break. So stay with us, listeners, on Connect the Dots. Today we're talking with David Murphy and Lisa Stocky of Food Democracy Now!, along with Tara Cook-Littman of GMO Free Connecticut, about their recent outstanding win, Connecticut becoming the first state to unanimously, pretty much by the legislators, and with the governor poised to sign the bill, calling for GMO labeling. So stay tuned for the second half of our show. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On today's show, we're talking about recent victories in labeling GMOs, the recent victory in Connecticut. Speaking today with our wonderful guests, Dave Murphy and Lisa Stocky, co-founders and directors of Food Democracy Now!, and Tara Cook-Littman, the director of GMO Free Connecticut, who worked for 2 years building a grassroots organization that spearheaded the efforts to get GMO labeling in the first state in the United States. If you've missed the first half of our show, it's worth a listen. You can find it in the Connect the Dots show archives. If you like the show, please like us on iTunes and pass it along to your friends and others who would be interested. So, you know, in the first part of the show, we kind of ended the first half hour talking about, you know, how to sort of talk to legislators, how to really kind of do that grassroots networking, the kinds of conversations that really, you know, we talked about how numbers, people showing up, people calling, people at rallies, but there's also, you know, those personal conversations that really persuade. And I'd love to hear more from you, Tara Cook-Littman, about how, you know, if you have any gems to share from your experiences in doing this in Connecticut, in persuading your legislators and turning them around on this issue to get the terrific vote that just happened this past weekend.
Sure. Well, on the most basic level, people really need to start with their own legislators and develop a good relationship with them. And in my town, we actually have three representatives and one state senator. And the four of them were some of our biggest champions there. And it was because of the relationship I developed with them, and they trusted the information that I was giving to them. So I really urge everyone, whether it's GMO labeling you care about or something else, make appointments with your own representatives and senators at the state and federal level, because they will meet with you. People are afraid, they're nervous, but you shouldn't be. You elected them to office, they work for you, and reach out to them and make an appointment. And if they don't get back to you right away, keep trying until they do sit down with you. So that's really a first step, and really the most basic thing that we can do to exercise our democratic rights. And then after that, meet other like-minded people that care about the same things that you do, and start building a group of people that can work together.
Mm-hmm. How big a group did you actually have in Connecticut?
Well, we had a leadership team of about 30 people throughout the state, and we had a database that probably started with about 20 people, and I'm not sure of the exact numbers now. I'm sure it's gone up recently, but we were somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 on our database, and then our Facebook page, you know, also keeps growing. I think it's over 4,000 likes now, which for a very small grassroots organization with absolutely no funding is pretty big, and when we put up big post announcements about the Senate passing the bill, we had over a million views on Facebook and 17,000 shares. So Dave is right that social media today is really critical. We had an incredible social media director doing that work for us.
That's fantastic. And, you know, if people feel intimidated by, you know, speaking with their legislators, what tips would you offer?
Well, I would say that you should go in with a game plan and have about 3 points that you know you want to get across to them, right? Because you don't have forever, especially with something like GMOs and labeling. It's a very intense subject, and there's a lot to learn. So whenever I went in to meet with somebody new and it was the first time they were learning about the topic, I would just have 3 points that I knew I wanted to make and stick to those points. And that's very much, I think, what you do also when you're doing something in media. But if you know you have somebody's attention for a very short amount of time, get your critical points across. And have it written out, and always bring some documentation or handouts, articles that you can leave with them on their desk. So, you know, for instance, with GMO labeling, I always knew that I wanted to go in and I wanted to get the point across that, one, other countries are labeling, America's way far behind, two, GMOs were actually never proven safe, and three, we just have a right to know. And those were really the three things that we hammered on with our legislators right from the start. And those are very accessible points to get across. And you don't have to be an expert. That's why I say bring information with you. Give them studies and articles that can be the expert for you. You're just a person going in there and letting them know about what you care about.
Let's talk a little bit about the studies, because recently a book was put forth where they claimed there were studies. It's all been proven already. Can either you or Dave and Lisa comment on, you know, what is the actual reality in terms of what we know about what the safety or health impacts of this are?
That's a really good question. I think the real problem is we don't know a whole lot because Monsanto controls the research and controls the science. I think in 2010, 26 entomologists or bug scientists wrote to the EPA saying, listen, we can't even get approval to write about the science, you know, to research the science here. And it's really alarming as scientists. They wrote that. It appeared in the New York Times. It appeared in Nature magazine. And the fact is, but the truth is, there is new and emerging science studies that show there is potential significant harm to human health and the environment and to mammals. I think, if anyone's familiar with the GMO movement, are they, the pro-science part of this movement? Dr. Arpad Pusztai in England in the 1990s, he was actually a biotech scientist, and he was hired by the British government to show the safety of these products. What happened? Interestingly enough, he conducted several studies, and he found actually that in his studies that the GMO potatoes that they were trying to get approved in England, the ones that he planted and fed to the rats, actually caused them immune problems, lower birth weight, and alarmingly, even more alarming, smaller brain size for those rats in his study. Recently, a French professor, scientist came out, Seralini, came out with a study that showed that, a two-year, one of the longest peer-reviewed scientific studies that's ever been conducted, a two-year feeding study with Roundup and Monsanto's Roundup Ready Corn, showed that after 4 months, significant health problems started showing up, including cancer cancerous tumors. And those are some real problems. And then just last month, MIT professor Stephanie Seneff and Anthony Samsel came out with a study, a comprehensive review of scientific papers on Roundup, which is a main weed killer, and its main chemical component, glyphosate, show that there's possible links to Parkinson's, obesity, infertility, and cancer as a result of the use of Roundup, which not only do farmers spray on all our fields, but most Americans use at one point during the year on their lawns. So I just say there's new and emerging science that shows potential harm, and the American government needs to take it seriously. The Obama administration needs to take this stuff seriously. They can no longer, bury their head in the sand and ignore the fact that these GMO crops and their chemicals and the herbicides that are used along with them may be harmful to human health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's a combination of the pesticides, the herbicides, and the actual genetic modification in the product. It's like a bunch of different things. It's not just one thing that is problematic.
Absolutely.
And since you've last appeared on the show, actually, you've just traced the history of the health evidence, but it's growing. There's a sense, I know the Seralini study was criticized. It was featured in Seeds of Deception. It's been criticized. I mean, what is this kind of situation in the science community where there, we were taught science is objective, it's pristine, it's certain. What is the situation where you have, some scientists saying one thing and other scientists saying something else?
Well, I mean, listen, it reminds me of the Reformation. I think in a lot of ways that Monsanto acts like the Catholic Church, and Torquemada. I mean, I think they're really cracking down on any scientist that talks about harm for their crops. Mm-hmm. It's basically character assassination. The minute that a scientist comes out with a study that shows harm and possible harm for their products, hey, listen, they absolutely destroyed Seralini in the media. And the fact is the mainstream media is so dumb about science and ignorant about the politicization and the corporatization of our scientific methods here in the U.S. and how they're reported in the media that they failed to actually tell the true story. Seralini actually designed that study, a two-year study, to mimic and to, follow the same protocols that Monsanto used in their 90-day feeding study that got their crop approved in France and in Europe. So the fact is you're using, Monsanto says, well, you're using these rats. These scientists came forward. You're using these rats that are naturally predisposed to cancer. Yeah, they're called Sprague Gully rats, and they're used mostly used in toxicity studies to show How? Because they have a propensity to cancer. So they show cancer pretty quickly, and that's the same type of rat that Monsanto used in their
study. So they're critiquing the rat, but it's the same rat that they use to show safety.
Absolutely.
And why did they come up with a different result?
Okay, so it's easy to, you know, so Monsanto, what they did is they did a 90-day study. That's 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably covered the adolescence of a human.
Mm-hmm.
But Sara Laney did a 2-year study, which would be the full life cycle of that rat.
Mm.
It would be the full life of a human. And what they showed at 4 months, the first 90 days, there weren't any health problems that showed up. But at 4 months, health problems started showing up in those rats. And they became worse. They became accumulative as time went on.
Mm.
So, you know, if Monsanto is submitting 90-day health death studies on rats to get approvals, or here in the U.S. and in Europe, the American people should rightfully be alarmed if a major peer-reviewed study comes along and shows up that the health problems show up in 4 months. Now, the fact is, it's one study. It should be replicated several times.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the USDA and the FDA should be on notice that the food, that the agricultural paradigm that our country has spent the last 20 years getting behind is potentially deeply flawed, not only for human health, but also for the environment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the studies that came out in the 90s that showed that there was a problem with butterflies, or early 2000s that showed there was a problem with monarch butterflies. Well, they destroyed that scientist in the media, and only years later it shows that, yes, populations of butterflies are declining because of GMOs, because of GMO pollen and the herbicides they used.
So basically it creates delays, it creates confusion, time passes and they kind of put the product forth, obviously not everything will necessarily be borne out, but you're pointing out that a number of these things have been. So...
The bigger point this is absolutely a flawed and failing science in the field of farmers and on our plate.
Mm-hmm.
Monsanto knows that. You know, I call it cigarette science. The tobacco companies lied to us for 40 years about the safety of their products. Monsanto has a long history of approving some of the most toxic chemicals on the planet for human health and the environment, PCPs. Dioxin, DDTs, and now they're creating the food on our plate. They have a long history of not being honest about the science. And so I'll just say it's very reasonable for your American citizens and for nonprofits and for other scientists to say, so you're not really being honest about the science here.
Mm-hmm.
You're not being open. You're not being transparent. They have contracts. Of course, what happens is the way the contracts are written, Monsanto gets to if a scientist does a study in the U.S., they get to cherry pick. They get to read the study before it's published, and then they get to edit out what they don't want. Does that sound like science to you?
I was about to say, that's not science. So because they're funding it, is the mechanism by which this happens just political, you know, lobbyist pressure? Hey, you can't study us unless we have the right to do it. Or is it that they're actually paying for the study? And so whoever is doing the study is, in effect, working for them.
It's both. They've written the contracts in a way because it's called, you know, proprietary intellectual property, that they get to control the results. And they have to, a scientist has to sign a disclaimer saying that the company gets to review it and also have a say in the results that are published.
So the fact
that it's
proprietary means... Excuse me, I'm sorry, but the fact that it's proprietary means that they get to control the science? I mean, once you declare something as proprietary, then there's no opportunity for independent study of what the problem might be or if there is a problem because it's been defined as proprietary? Is that really true?
Yeah, I mean, the reports we've read of scientists, that they have had their stuff edited before it's published.
Wow.
And they, you know, listen, Monsanto regularly, they have installed pro-biotech scientists on top of these, at the head of these editorial boards, these major scientific peer-reviewed journals. There's just a story that came out last month about that happening. And they've infiltrated every segment of our society to be a roadblock against exposing the truth of their products. I think that's one of the things that really alarms your average American when they start investigating this. The fact that Clarence Thomas is at the Supreme Court, the fact that Michael Taylor is at the FDA. You know, I think that, people start looking at it and they see a pattern, a revolving door. And the thing is, a revolving door, there's only one benefit. It benefits Monsanto. It doesn't benefit the American public.
You know, people will say about the revolving door, and there's a revolving door all throughout, you know, all throughout government and in every single agency. And so the presumption is the people from the, you know, GMO industry, from the biotech industry, from the nuclear industry, they know more. If they come from that industry, presumably they know more and therefore in a better position to regulate, so that they would be a preferred hire because they already kind of up to speed. But that's really, it's kind of, it flies in the face of independent science to, you know, for the regulators and the people.
That's like saying we should only have axe murderers be jury members of a murder trial. It really is. Because they know all about it. You know, it's really, that's a horrific way to view it. And that's a convenient, you know, careerist, social climbing, you know, corporate way to look at stuff. It's not very, I mean, we had people regulating these things before corporations decided to get their executive class in to write the rules and regulations to benefit their corporate profits. It's not that difficult to understand some of the science behind this. You know, people go to college, the FDA and the EPA and the USDA, they hire very qualified people that haven't worked in corporations every day. We're very smart, very talented, and know how to look at a problem. And that's the thing. So the FDA, 20 years ago, when they were trying to originally write the rules and regulations that govern biotech products, the scientists on staff at the FDA were overridden by Michael Taylor and people with a background of working for corporations. They made a political decision. The FDA's own scientists, these are career scientists at the Food and Drug Administration, said that the fact biotechnology is a very different from traditional, you know, breeding, and it does introduce new risks into food. They have possibly an increase of toxicants and allergens into our food supply. That's what the FDA's own scientists said. The problem was that Monsanto had installed Michael Taylor, former attorney for Monsanto, into the FDA, and he and a few other political appointees in the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, were able to use their influence to override the concerns of the FDA's own scientists.
And then, you know, when they're done, they either stay there or they go back to the industry. So it's very clear, you know, where their loyalties lie. So basically, they overrode the independent scientists within their own organization early on to get this thing going. And then they've sat on it and claim that it's proven. But, you know, one thing that strikes me about the rat study that you mentioned is that they studied for 4 months, and the health effects started showing up after 4 months. One can only hypothesize, but, you know, if the scientist is in your employ, if because it's a, you know, a sort of a trademarked ingredient, they get to oversee how the science research is done, they could have stopped the study, you know, or failed to report the back end of the study if, for example, they had done it for 5 months. I mean, we don't know that that happened, but that kind of thing could potentially happen. In other words, they may have even found something similar, but if you don't look long enough, you can say, oh, well, we studied it up to here, no problem. And then, of course, so it takes really funding and all kinds of things to look at enough animals, to look at them long enough, to look at them under the conditions, you know, the right controls and everything else. And so it's kind of like, you know, the behest is on these independent researchers to do this, and then when they come out with something, you know, there's some kind of detail of, you know, the purest science that's critiqued, But meanwhile, we don't have the purest science on the other side of the equation. You know, it's amended, it's edited, it's paid for, it's, you know, so there's really, you know, there's a pretense of a scientific debate. But what we really have is kind of, you know, some science on the side of looking at the problem, and a lot of science that's kind of been cooked, you know, potentially.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it, science that has been cooked. That's, mm-hmm. Every American needs to know this. The Food and Drug Administration, the USDA, and the EPA, they do not conduct independent peer-reviewed scientific tests on these products. They rely on corporations to submit their own scientific studies that they've conducted with scientists that they pay, that are on their payroll, for the approval process. You know, you want to... And the other thing is, people should also know, in the 1992 draft guidance that governs a policy over biotechnology, biotech products, and GMO foods, the FDA said it's not our job to vouch for the safety of these products. That's what the corporations are to do. Monsanto's PR person said, it's not our job to vouch for the safety of these products. That's what the FDA is. That's the FDA's job. Our job is to sell these products. So they have a loophole here that you could drive freight train through, and they know it. And that's why today, under FDA policy, biotech crops and GMOs are considered statutorily equivalent, or they're generally regarded as safe, because if it looks like corn and it smells like corn and it tastes like corn, there's no difference. That's why we don't have a label in the United States and 64 other countries around the world, all our major trade partners, Europe, Russia, China, India, they have labeling, but the American people have been denied that right.
And this is, I mean, I just did a piece on Alternet on the safer chemicals legislation, because sadly, Senator Frank Lautenberg, who was the big champion of regulating and studying the 85,000 chemicals in use that have never been studied, it's the same situation. He recently passed away this week and left as his legacy, very sadly, after years of trying to fight with a lot of chemistry industry pushback, he left, you know, a kind of compromised bill in, you know, that he co-sponsored in the last week of his life, and I have a piece about that on Alternet. But it's the same thing in that industry. It's the same thing with the assertions of safety of chemicals in the fracking industry. I mean, this is like a systemic, across-the-board problem. And at some point, you know, there was a turn where it was kind of okay for industry, people with an industry background to enter these agencies, and then a further step was taken. And now there's actually, you know, where the science was put on them. And actually, as you describe, it's in a no-man's zone now, with no one actually looking at it and guaranteeing it. As people eat these foods or absorb toxic chemicals or are at risk for poisoned water, and everybody believes that someone is minding the store. And what you're actually saying is that nobody is minding the store, and it's up to us.
Yeah, to say that nobody minding the store is to put it lightly. You know, there's just, like you said, I mean, 84,000 chemicals. There's a story in the New York Times about them not being properly reviewed. And it's kind of alarming. These are the chemicals that are interacting with our bodies, with the environment. We have obesity rates skyrocketing. We have autism and ADD rates skyrocketing. What's the cause? It's either our food or some chemical in the environment. Why isn't the federal government trying to protect us? You know, that's a real question. Why do we elect these people, like Barack Obama and our members of Congress? Why do we elect these people based on the lie that they're going to protect us, when in fact we now know they're not? I mean, the Obamas should be ashamed of themselves. They allegedly plant an organic garden, and then they force GMOs down our throat, unlabeled. I mean, it's appalling. Obama promised Iowa farmers in 2007, an event that I organized, that he would label genetically engineered foods. You know, miraculously, it's just like Guantanamo. He gets elected, and then he forgets his promise. I think the situation in Guantanamo is a little different, but, you know, Obama needs to label genetically engineered foods. Congress needs to label them. The victory in Connecticut this week is just the beginning. I mean, it's the beginning in a lot of ways for the American people waking up and taking back their power in their government process back from their elected officials who've really developed too cozy of a relationship with corporate lobbyists who seem to be able to convince them magically of almost every lie that a corporate lobbyist tells an elected official is never going to benefit the American people. I think we learned that with credit default swaps and the housing
bubble.
Well,
we learned it all across the board, and this is a way that we're kind of turning it back. We're coming to the end of our show here, so I really want to thank you, Dave Murphy, Lisa Stocky, Tara Cook-Littman, for being with us talking about GMOs today. Listeners, please pass the show along, like it on iTunes, and come back next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time to be with me here on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Have a great week.